This is the Major.
This is Joe Turner.
Identification?
My name is Turner. I work for you. Now listen.
Identify yourself.
What is your designation?
Condor.
Something has happened. Section 9, Department 17.
The section's been hit.
What level?
What level?
Level of damage.
Everybody. Dr. Lapp, Janice, Ray, Harold. Everybody is dead.
Are you damaged?
Damaged? No.
Are you armed? Identify the armament.
It's a 45 automatic. Will you guys bring me in, please? I'm not a field agent. I just read books.
This is the panic office.
Section 917 may have been hit.
Hit confirmed.
What was the quality of work?
Clean, fast, first rate.
Except they overlooked one item. You say one of my people is still okay?
Condor, you know him?
No.
Deputy Director Higgins, New York Center. I'm controlling now, Condor. Where are you?
How come I need a code name and you don't?
The head of your department just came here from D.C. He's going to bring you home.
I've never met him.
No worry.
2 years military service. Separated 961. Worked at Bell Labs Communication Research College on the G.I. Bill.
This Condor isn't the man his file says he is.
But wait a minute. I don't...
Get in the car. Don't make a sound. Don't be dumb. Come on, hurry up.
I work for the CIA. I am not a spy.
Your assignment for today was to go out and kidnap a girl.
I'll need your help.
Have I ever denied you anything? I don't think you're going to live much longer.
Well, I may surprise you.
Condor is an amateur. He's lost, unpredictable. He could fool a professional. Yes?
Do you believe the Condor is really an endangered species?
Include the Condor episode without any more noise. If company agents aren't enough, use freelance. Use whatever it requires, but end it.
Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway in danger and in love in 3 days of the Condor.
Well, we are springing into conspiracies this month. That's right. We're going to talk about the true origin story of what happened when our very own David used to intern at the Literary Historical Society. We're looking at 3 days of the Condor this week. Welcome back to a brand new episode of Reconcinimation. I'm your host, John Diner.
I'm David Munchak.
I'm Brent Hutchins.
And this is the podcast that takes a look back at some of our favorite films from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And we're checking out how they hold up here today. So we looked at Marathon Man on our last episode, and we're actually going to go the year prior to that, 1975, with Sidney Pollack's 3 Days of the Condor.
We're only getting older here, going backwards. We're going backwards, guys.
You know, just going to throw out here before we get started on the episode, we have a mailbag episode coming up. So everybody listening right now, hit us up with your questions. You can send us questions about the movie industry, behind the scenes, personal questions about us and, you know, our opinions on certain films, anything you guys want to know movie wise, just send it our way. You can tweet at us. We're at Reconcinimation Podcast on Twitter. We're on Instagram, Facebook. Hit us up at any of those. You can direct message us, whatever your preference, and we'll air those coming up on a future episode.
Ooh, neat. Yeah.
Can't wait. That's going to be exciting.
Yes. Something new, something different. We're going to try
shaking
it
up.
Yeah. We're going to have one of those, you know, the lottery, those roller things that they pull the lotto, you know,
I've got one.
Numbers.
No, I actually, that's not even like typically this bit we would joke and be like, oh yeah, we've got one in the recon offices. I actually really do have one. so we'll use it. We can use it.
Yeah. Is it a bingo cage or a lottery?
Yeah, it's a brass bingo cage. And it's massive. Nice. We used to use it at work for,
I feel like I've seen it in the back, the background of your video feed in days of past.
Yeah, my kids stole it when I stopped using it for work, and they started using it for their own purposes, but I can reclaim it. We can definitely put that in.
We're gonna need it. We've already, the mailman or mail person came by the office, bags of handwritten letters to the studio.
How else are we gonna choose? We can't get through all of them.
Yeah, we're gonna
name them on little ping pongs.
Exactly. Yes.
We'll just number them.
Yolanda Vega is gonna pull them out for us.
This is envelope B11. Let's be 11.
All right, cool. So, all right, 3 days of the Condor. Brent, what's happening in this film?
Oh, God, I don't know, John. What's happening in this film? This movie's about a dude named Turner, who, codenamed Condor, who is kind of a low-level CIA agent working in an office, and he goes to lunch to pick up sandwiches for his crew, and when he gets back, they're all dead. So the movie's about him trying to figure out why his pals are dead and the CIA trying to hunt him down because, well, we don't know. Do they want to hunt him down because he's the one that killed the other CIA agents, or is there something else afoot? Or is there a CIA in the CIA? I don't know. There's so much going on. The conspiracies fly high here. And that is a wrap. That's it. That's what I got for you. We'll have to figure it out the rest of the show.
That is perfect, Brent. I'm proud of you.
I better get an email that says as much because, yeah, you're all talk, John. You're all talk.
I'll have my office send your office a inner office memo.
Send a fan letter.
I'll hand it to the mail person to bring down to your office. Yeah, all right, great. David, bring us back in our Reconcentra time capsule. Let's rewind to, where are we, September 1975?
Yes, September 25th is when this movie was released for audiences in the U.S. So, yes, we have Gerald Ford sitting in the White House, fresh off his two separate assassination attempts from Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane Moore earlier in that month. Future NFL quarterback Matt Hasselbeck is born on this day. September 25th. Fame by David Bowie and Rhinestone Cowboy by Glenn Campbell are tearing up the Billboard Top 100. And John Denver is at number one with I'm Sorry in the US, and Rod Stewart is number one with Sailing in the UK. And this fall, TV audiences welcomed into their living rooms, Welcome Back, Connor, and Wonder Woman. And as usual, something probably happened in sports, but who cares? That's all we got in 1975.
That is quite a sports summary. I love it.
Yeah. We don't have time for sports ball on this show.
There's no reason. Who cares? It's all in the past. It's over.
Go check your other podcast for that nonsense.
Go to your statistics pages, ESPN.com. Go ahead. Whatever. Yeah. They'll tell you everything you need to know about 1975.
That's what they're there for.
That's what they're there for. Nobody cares.
All right, Gerald Ford, two assassination attempts.
Yeah, Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane Moore. Separate attempts, like within a month, not even a month, like a couple weeks.
Yeah,
in September. So,
of all the presidents,
yeah, the guy who wasn't even elected, I know. Less. So
he really didn't do, you know, I mean, what he's coming in, stepping into, like he didn't do any of that. So
yeah. The divisive figure, Gerald Ford.
All right.
Those were the days.
Yeah, it sure was. Okay, 3 days of the Condor. Brent, when was the first time when did this movie come on your radar?
Pretty early on, but only because for whatever reason, I don't know if my family or friends of family that we were hanging out at the house just had a love of Redford, or maybe it was just, there was a bunch of Redford on TV, but I always remember like this being on Brubaker, The Natural, like maybe in a block, like back to back to back, like the Redford block or whatever. But like it was early. So, I mean, that was, you know, Natural was like 84. So, you know, probably 85, 86, you know, during that time when all these things were just on rerun constantly on television and HBO and whatnot, is really the first time I'd seen it. I had no idea what was going on in this movie at that point. Like, you know, there are moments that I remember Same with Brubaker. Natural's really the only one that like really stuck with me, but you know, we were kind of a baseball family, so that was like over and over and over again. But that was kind of the first time I was introduced to it. I hadn't really seen it in full like context where I could process what was going on until right around college. It may have been late high school, early college, but I hadn't watched it again since then, I don't think, until just, you know, getting ready for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And cool. I have to tell you, I'm not done seeing it now.
Here we go.
Seeing it now, being as old as I am and everything, you know, there's some stuff going on in this movie that I'm just like, what the fuck, man?
Yeah. We're going to get to all of that, because I think we may have the same opinion. But David, what about you? Is this a new watch for you, or had you seen it before?
I had not seen it before. It never registered with me. It never came up. I never had an epiphany to have like a Redford retrospective or a Von Cito retrospective or a Faye Dunaway retrospective. This movie never came across.
Haven't done Von Cito Fest?
Is that how we say his name? Von Cito or Cito? Yep. I always said Cito growing up. So
I think it's
Cito. Being from Texas, we don't know how to say things correctly.
I'm only biased. I had an English professor, Dr. Cito. But he didn't have the Von in front of it, though. So it was an Americanized version. Anyway, that's why I say Von Cito.
No, that's good. I'm glad. Thank you for teaching.
But I don't think it's correct. I don't know how he went by it, is all I'm saying.
I've always heard it as Von Cito, so.
Yeah. So anyway, who knows? Or even Sidney Pollack. So yeah, this is not a film that, you know, it would have been out for like 10 years before I even started registering what movies are in my consciousness, let alone be old enough to even want to see it, where this would make an impact. So this is a great first time watch for me this week.
Nice. All right. Very interested to hear your thoughts as usual.
I don't want to hear what I have to say. Yeah.
This was a late watch for me. As you know, we talked about in our Marathon Man episode, when I went through all my 70s, you know, discovery phase.
The 70s.
Those gritty.
Yeah. Gritty movies. Films are so good. Sorry. Every time the decade comes up, I'm inclined to just do that for no reason.
Yeah,
I'm not making
it's a grotesque passion for John, these 70s grit-filled films.
You have to like acknowledge it, like, raw. Yeah, 70s movies were real.
Look at that film stock. You can see the scratches,
the grain.
Oh my god, look at that film grain. The contrast is so bad. All right.
But I missed both of these, Marathon Man and Marathon Man. I did watch in college, or you know, high school, but not when I kind of watched the bulk of them. And this one I did not catch until way later on. I didn't see this till like 2003, when I got my first Netflix subscription.
Hey,
and I was so fascinated. Like, you could get three discs at a time. And then I just mail it, and then the next one on my list just comes automatically. Like, this is amazing.
I do remember the early days of Netflix. It was kind of amazing.
It was early adopters.
It was awesome.
Yeah, you just like, you're on the website, like I can organize like what I want to watch, and you know,
change the
not
queue.
Really thinking about we're robbing the world of the video store. But that's what was happening.
Yeah.
Sadly. So I had also got those Toshin books, the movies of the, you know, I got the movies of the 60s, 70s and 80s. And I went through and was, you know, added to my list, like every movie in those books that I hadn't seen that was available at the time. Nice. So finally, when this one came, that was the first time I had seen it. So this was like 2003 or four when I got around to it. And it was really, I loved it the first time I saw it, and where I started to discover Sidney Pollack films, who we haven't Sidney Pollack hasn't come up on the show before. This is really the first time. And he is absolutely one of my favorite. I wouldn't say he's like the great, you know, top 10 director, but he's one of my personal favorites. I just enjoy so many of his films.
And he's a classic man.
Yeah. Like there's a bunch that are, you know, in there that are still discussed, you know, however they've aged, but, you know, Tootsie is definitely one we're going to have to talk about. I think we've had it on the list and then pulled it. And then it's,
I know we've mentioned it the last two episodes now because, it's Tootsie time.
Yeah. Tootsie time. But he's also a great, you know, director of thrillers, this being one of them. And, I just think he's a really fascinating filmmaker, and They Shoot Horses, Don't They? If you haven't seen that, that is an amazing film, but very hard to watch, very emotional, very just, it's a tough one, but it's a great film, and Jane Fonda's performance is incredible.
I have to check it out. I have not seen it. And to be honest, like, I understand Sidney Pollack's importance to filmmaking and the industry, but I would say that there have not been a lot of his movies that I've seen that I've been like, wow, that's amazing. So not to say that I haven't, but I think my love is different for Sidney than John's might be.
There's definitely some that I don't love, let's say that too, that I just actually watched the 1995 Sabrina.
Oh,
that I struggled with that.
The remake of Sabrina.
Yeah. Wow. It was a very different movie than the original while still being almost identical. It just did not work, but I love, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? The Electric Horseman, The Absence of Malice with Paul Newman and Sally Field is a fantastic film. Tootsie, of course, Out of Africa is Out of Africa. That's like your Oscar movie. And that was, you know, Sidney won Best Director and Best Picture for that. And but like Havana is a movie I feel like I tried to watch that twice with my grandmother and fell asleep both times. And so it's a little like kind of up and down, but most of the, you know, late 70s, you know, Jeremiah Johnson's another one. The Yakuza with Robert Mitchum is a great film. So they kind of range all over, but I hear what you're saying. What's your least favorite that you've seen of his?
That I've seen of his, let's see, going through. Well, probably Sabrina.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm just in general, like remakes that people don't ask for. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily on him or just the fact that that was made.
I agree. I mean, I agree. I think that one in particular, the cast is, while all great actors, it was like, I don't think they gelled, the three of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that was great. I don't know. I don't want to get into what I think was his worst. I haven't seen a whole bunch. But the ones that I see, like I find her maybe fine stories, but none of them like kind of, you know, like Out of Africa. Okay. Like I know when that movie came out, it was massively successful and like you couldn't go 10 feet without hearing people talking about it. It felt like, but yeah. I just, you know, there's so many other movies that I would watch before watching that. If I was going through the Academy, like movies of the past, like, I don't know, you know, like, I don't know. And I mean, and we'll get into this one here in a second, but there are definitely things about this movie that I have thoughts on that, maybe more guided by just present day sensibilities, but Even in retrospect, some of the stuff, just like, what is going on?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this was a different watch for me than the way I remembered the movie.
Yeah.
Which, so we'll kind of get into it, but just a little recap about Sidney. He was, he's just so interesting because he's also an actor and appeared in a lot of things that he did not direct. Like he's in Eyes Wide Shut and he's in one episode of The Sopranos in the last season. That is a great, great small part. But he was always so likable to me as an actor that I always have an affinity for him. And
well, and I'm with you there. Like, I actually, as an actor, I like him quite a bit.
Yeah.
As an actor, I think he's like, you know, plenty of his roles are memorable. I just don't find his movies as memorable, like the ones he directed, as memorable as the ones he acted in, I guess.
Yeah, he came up through the New York theater world in the late 50s, and kind of the same time that wave of, you know, the new Hollywood group, and just prior to that was kind of coming in. So, you know, he was friends with the director John Frankenheimer, who convinced him to move out to LA and start working as a dialogue coach. So he started working with more and more actors. He really wasn't like a film buff or anything, but he ends up befriending Burt Lancaster, who convinces him to start directing because he works really well with actors. So he starts directing TV, does a lot of episodes of The Fugitive and the Alfred Hitchcock Hour in the early 60s, and then jumps over to feature films. And a lot of people, you know, talk about this movie in particular, how it has Hitchcock elements in it. And Sidney has talked about, he's like, I was friends with Hitchcock and spent a lot of time with him, like just socially, but I never watched any of his movies, and I knew of them, but like, I was never a fan, never even saw most of them. So he's like, so I think that's just a coincidence, but
it was osmosis. He ends up meeting,
what's that?
I said it was osmosis, just by spending time with Hitchcock. Right. He absorbed some of that.
Totally. He, as an actor, he meets Robert Redford on the set of War Hunt, which was in the very early 60s. And they would end up collaborating 7 times. So that's the actor I think he worked with most. He worked with Harrison Ford a few times. He worked, you know, did recur with a number of actors, but that was his kind of, his go-to guy was Redford. He, his films have a total of 48 Oscar nomination and 11 Oscar wins. He was nominated for Best Director 4 times, winning for Out of Africa. And going into this movie, he was coming off of They Shoot Horses, Don't They, Jeremiah Johnson, The Way We Were, and The Yakuza, which I just say that one again. It's a really cool kind of a gangster Robert Mitchum 70s movie. It's one worth watching for sure. And then some others, you know, like I mentioned, Electric Horseman, Absence of Malice, Tootsie, Out of Africa, and The Firm. He was also a huge producer and got a lot of people started behind the scenes and was a big mentor of other directors. And I believe David Fincher was somebody that he kind of took under his wing. So he's an important filmmaker that you don't hear, you know, is not really spoken of today, but definitely there's some films in there that had quite an impact. And I think more of like who he impacted, you know, their careers along the way.
We should check in with friend of the show, Joe Zetta. I believe he can say that he saw the Sabrina remake 4 times in theaters that holiday season.
Really?
It was not his, yeah.
He was taken there.
I think he had obligations under duress to see it with like multiple different people.
Was it a hostage situation?
Like, I don't know. I want to say it was like 4 times. I remember him telling me this like a little later in life, and I was like, "What?"
It was a big movie.
It's like I ended up seeing, and he hated it from day one, from minute one. Like, but he had seen it a lot of times. He made me do it. I'm sure
Joe's going to be back on the show soon, so we'll get his thoughts.
Yeah, just get the Sabrina account from him. Like, what's your Sabrina account? How many times have you seen this movie? Anyway,
I remember when I worked at Suncoast, that, you know, that's when that came out on video, and we got boxes of it, and it was a huge seller.
Yeah. It was always on the video screen.
Sure.
At at Video Impact as well.
Yeah.
I remember when it came out. It was awful.
All right. So going back to the 70s, what was your gut reaction coming out of this movie? David, let's start with you. Brent, then we'll come back to your thoughts. But what did you think? How did you feel about it?
So gritty. So real.
Raw.
So raw. Yeah. I don't know. I can see the that 70s thriller foundation being set, and just the ticking clock of it all, you know, a guy on the run. Like, I dig it. Like, I jump into the whole story. Like, what's he gonna do? How's he gonna get out of this? It seemed like he had no, I'm like, after everyone was killed, I'm like, he's screwed. There's no one left. What's he gonna do? And who knew that he might survive to the end? We don't know yet. If the beginning of the movie, you don't know if he's gonna make it, and we don't know how long he would live after the movie if he were to survive. So, you know, so I was kind of just drawn into the whole like, how's he gonna get through this? It's a little like a little convoluted and a little weird, but I don't know. It just seemed like it's a nice way to play on that paranoia and all that stuff of back then. But it really made me think. I'm like, why do they still make movies like this now? It's always like this guy who does a secret thing and he's got to be, and then he's betrayed, and then everyone's gonna like take the Jason Bourne of it or whatever. But like, it's just like, that's such a big, it's such an easy story to do, right? Like a guy who does something, didn't know, everyone above him is gonna, knows more than him, can kill him at any time, is always a big threat. It's an overly, it's like, why are we still doing these stories today? Because yeah. it's so boring to me today, like, because it's overdone. Because we have run out of narrative.
How many stories? hundreds at least of times have we seen this story?
Yeah. So I don't know when this movie was released, how popular, like that kind of story. I don't know how many times we've seen it in film.
It became really popular.
Yeah.
Post this movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, but this and the Parallax View were the start of it, because up until, you know, what
people, Brent, trusted the government until then.
Exactly. Like, up until Watergate, there was a general trust of the government that had been unraveling during Nixon's presidency, but really blew up after Watergate.
Well, and so, just to jump in here real quick, part of the concern while they were making this movie, because this actually, so they were introducing the idea of the government not being trustworthy in this movie. Like, Watergate actually hadn't happened yet when they started filming, and they had a lot of concerns on while they were writing it about whether or not people would really go for it. And so just by happenstance, serendipity, they freaking Watergate happened, and it was like the first thing out of the gate. And so like, I think that actually, I have thought about this, and I'm curious if this movie gets so much credit because it was like the first shot, right? And because after rewatching it, I got lots of things, but like, I think the popularity of this movie is based off the fact that it was kind of the first thing that after people really got gut punched by the Watergate thing, this is out, and it's Redford, who's huge at the time. And they're like, oh, Redford, like, they like, wow, how quickly can you make movies? You know, like, this thing happened right afterwards. And so it was just perfect timing. But, you know, it ends up doing well. Redford is obviously hugely popular. Faye Dunaway is hugely popular. And from that point on, you start seeing these movies all the time. And to your point, David, they're still made.
I mean, All the President's Men comes out only a few months after this.
Right.
And I don't begrudge any of those movies coming out for the next 10 years after this movie. Like, but it's just the same old thing, like, that is such an easy, and I think maybe like I think it's a lot of TV shows had to be so dramatic, especially in the last 20 years. So that whole thing, there's a lot of those, a lot of storylines. Yeah. Just like, and there's always someone who is good at something, but of course it's, if it's part of the government, or you see it even like, and if they work for a major corporation, that's like a, you know, there's always something else going on and they get mixed up in it and they'll kill you and you wouldn't even believe it. Like, you'd never know. It's like, yeah, boy, same old story. But yeah, but that only just rings for me when I watch the movie. But I wasn't bored by this movie because I'd seen it 100 times. I was thrown in because I'm like, oh, this is establishing everything. This is kind of the origin of that in like movies and TV in the mainstream way.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing to remember about this movie, that looking at it now is not a perfect movie. Like, there's definitely problems along the way, story wise. And, but you have to, I think you do have to give it credit that it is the first, you know, basically the first of a subgenre, that it's laying out kind of like how this formula is going to work. And it, in a general sense, it's very effective at that. And obviously it worked because we're still doing this movie, you know, 45 years later, 50 years later.
Yeah.
We have a hard time of new, the, you know, in the last 20 years.
Well, there's only what, like 7 true original stories, right? Yeah, is that the count? Like, I feel like
Man versus Man, Man versus Nature, yeah. Man versus Sandwich, whatever.
It's, that's a lot my of different.
There's some really grueling battles of Man versus Sandwich.
I win that battle every time.
Yeah. Sandwich never stands a chance.
But this has a lot of like big elements at this time, you know. Robert Redford is arguably the number one actor at the time. There's a lot, I think, that could compete for that. Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman, Al Pacino, De Niro, you know, not quite yet, but.
Here's my thing. This movie drives me crazy because of all the small details of things that aren't right. And so, like, I think with some of the things that came later, maybe they fine tune it. And it's like silly stuff. Like, well, I mean, there's big things in this movie that I can't stand. Like, first of all,
go for it.
I don't believe in Robert Redford. I don't believe Robert Redford's character at all. Like, I actually think the character is fucking awful. And I don't think that he's really even that good in the movie. Like, I think, like, if I were to, like, John Houseman, Seedow and Cliff Robertson, like, those guys carry this movie for me, and really 75% of the movie, like, I can't stand, and 25% I can. And it's like the last 30 minutes of the movie where I'm like, okay, I like this part. But like, leading up to it, I don't believe that Robert Redford's some bumbling CIA guy, unless he's holding a gun, which he has god awful gun safety, dude. It started to piss me off in the scene that he was with what's her name? What's her name in the movie? Faye Dunaway's character, Kate.
Kathy.
Yeah. Like, he's like holding the gun by the barrel and he's got his finger on the trigger all over the place. Well, like,
I think that's intentional.
Yeah. But I would totally buy that because they have the whole scene where they're like, oh, you know, he's never had any gun, yada, yada. He's not a real agent. You know, he's even like, I just read books. Like, I'm not a field agent. I don't know what's going on. And then at the end of the movie, he's like sitting in the freaking telecoms office, like rerouting 50 phones to like who, you know, come on. You know, like, obviously he's a trained agent, and any agent in the CIA, whether you're a friggin' book reader or not, has to go through gun safety. And like, that part just like started to bug me a little bit. And that's just like a one-off little thing that I noticed that kind of pissed me off. The overall thing that bothered me about his character is obviously he kidnaps and rapes this lady and he's supposed to be the hero of the movie, you know, like,
yeah,
that is super problematic for me. Like, I don't care if you're Robert Redford, and a lot of like in the research reading this, like, everybody just glazes over it. Like, oh, at least he's Robert Redford, but no, that's fucking gross, dude. Like, he literally kidnaps this lady ties her up to her bathroom, comes back. She's got friggin' Stockholm syndrome. They end up sleeping together, and then they finish it off with some cheesy, half-assed fucking like Casablanca, like in front of a train station instead of an airport scene at the end. Like it's some big romance. Like fuck that. Like that to me was just kind of repulsive. And unfortunately, it's so like weaved in and out of the first three quarters of the movie that it drives me crazy, dude. I'm like, why is anybody like, why is she helping this guy? Like, why is, you know, like, and their story, I just didn't find interesting. Anytime Cliff Robertson showed up, I was like, this dude's fucking killing it. John Houseman, anytime he shows up, dude, like just his voice alone, I'm like, please keep talking.
Yeah.
And then Sydow was great. Like,
oh, he's so good. Well,
any scene he's in, he is fucking slaying. Let's put a pin in Joubert
because there's so much to talk about him. He's great.
He's so good. And that's why I like the last, you know, 30 minutes because, you know, he's in most of it. And it's like either Houseman, Robertson, or Sydow in the last 30 minutes. It's like three big scenes strung together with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
To finish it out, and I feel like it finishes really strong. So when I was watching it, it was a total roller coaster, because I mean, even at the beginning, like I like the invasion scene, sorry I'm jumping around a little bit, I did like the invasion scene, but the parts leading up to the invasion scene, like when he's in the office and Janice is there, Janice, that's her name, and they're like touching each other and he's like feeling her face in the office, I'm like, dude, this is like, I don't like
his girlfriend.
They're together though. I mean,
it doesn't fucking matter. It's weird.
Oh, okay.
It's weird. It was weird. And like, it felt,
affection is weird. No. Human affection is very strange. No,
I'm cold and heartless.
Yeah.
No, your but ways it's just
confuse
like,
me.
It just feels out of place. Like it just is not like, it was unnecessary.
Yeah.
Like they could have done that without like groping each other's faces in the office. Like I just was like, I don't know.
Kind of put me
in a weird mood to start. And then like, I just got fixated on like how weird he was with all the like female characters. And I was having a hard time watching this movie this time around.
Go ahead, David.
It is pretty cool that like his girlfriend that he works with was murdered, and the next day he sleeps with the woman he kidnapped.
Yeah, it's fucking weird, dude.
After she was murdered, like good stuff, man. I understand the stress is getting to you, but
and yikes. The dialogue between them and like just the leaps, like it all is like convenient and like just not earned. Like it's just I don't know. Like I just didn't really. It was a real struggle for me at first. I was like, I'm like, so, this needs to change. I feel gross. I felt gross after.
I'm going to take what you're saying just a little bit further in this.
I can't keep up with this.
Take it further.
Go farther. Go further. Go.
I'm not trying to tear apart the movie. It's just something that, especially watching from today's point of view, really sticks out that they're really leaning on to the Redford effect in this movie. Yeah. Like they are leaning on the fact that he is a charming, likable, attractive man, that everything will get like be given a pass because of that. And even in the character, like Kathy's character, really just, she doesn't really believe him, but she's so charmed by him and how beautiful he is, right? That's why she sleeps with him. I wouldn't say that he raped her.
I don't know. Like afterwards, the day after, like the morning after, when she comes out, like she says some pretty pointed retorts to him,
mm-hmm.
you know, like about how he had abducted her and all that stuff that seemed, it didn't necessarily say to me that she was like fully on board with what was happening, but like in the moment of being, you know, like having been tied up for however many hours it took him to you know, run around town and all that shit. Like, I don't know, man. It didn't feel good watching that.
Yeah, that's scenes. A tough
and
scene.
And it felt like, even if it wasn't, let's say she was totally into it, then it's just total horseshit, right? Like, yeah. There's no way that was earned in the way that it played out in the movie. Like, it's so a total garbage storyline.
How would you feel that would work if there was no sex scene? If not just that we didn't see it, but that it didn't happen.
I would have liked it a lot more if she got on board with him after the mailman had come to the house and tried to kill them. Like, to me, you get rid of all that like nasty shit that they were just trying to like promote sex in the 70s about, and you bring it to the mailman scene. Maybe you bring that scene up where the guy comes to her house and is trying to kill him, and then she's convinced that he's not some lunatic. But like, in what world is she convinced that he's not a lunatic when that happens? Like, there's nothing has happened to give that to her, dude. Like, it's,
I think you're 100% right. I mean, I think looking back at it now, and I don't know what, I think Sidney Pollack's had some thoughts on it too, from a later perspective as well. Yeah. But
I mean, I get it. It's a product of the time and stuff, but it's so egregiously offensive to me. Like, you know, like, and usually like, I'm like, okay, I'll give things a pass because they're part of the times. But like, this is like, I just, considering how much credit this movie gets and how much credit Sidney Pollack gets, like, something like this to me, like, is pretty aggressively misplaced.
Well, even a little further than that too, as far as Faye Dunaway goes, I mean, Faye Dunaway is one of the top actresses, I mean, probably the top actress of at this time, right? She's just coming off of Chinatown. She's just done Bonnie and Clyde. She's done, I mean, The Towering Inferno we covered here. Check it out in the archives at reconsideration.com. But yeah, I mean, she's amazing and is given a character that is so flawed and, you know, really not given a lot of credit for having gone through that. I agree. If you flip some of those scenes, that would make sense for her character to get on board with him and realize that he's right. He's not crazy. Like, look, this guy just tried to kill us. So he's got to be telling the truth.
Yeah. I just, you know, and yeah, just the way that,
and there's no real conclusion for her character. He just kind of like, they just kind of separate ways when he's done meeting her.
There's no real conclusion for his character either. You know, like, we don't.
Well, that's,
you know,
intentional. And I like that. I mean, the ending is something I do like, but.
I agree. But I'm just saying, like, it's kind of a, you know, it's a repeated kind of thing in the course of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those were the big negatives for me. Like, everything you just talked about was really what stuck out for me too. That was like, ooh, we're not.
Yeah.
This is tough to sit through, this relationship here.
Yeah, kind of the only scene that I give credit to, like, I mean, again, so take away the face fondling from the opening that just didn't sit right with me. The actual invasion scene is really good at the beginning.
Really, like, good.
It builds a lot of suspense and tension. It reminded me, and I know that this is so much time afterwards, but I saw this horrific documentary about the Charlie Hebdo terrorist attacks in France. And it like absolutely reminded me of some of the footage that they had of that. And I was like, man, this is just really effective. And then the scene on the elevator with, I'm going back to Max again, but like with the scene on the elevator between Redford and Seidel, is I think also really, really effective at building tension and like really brilliant. And then beyond that though, up until we get to like the, not even Redford on the phones, but the opposite side of that, where he's talking to Clifton and Hausman's there, like the Hausman side of that conversation, especially afterwards when he's talking to Clifton about like if he's the right man for this. And then Hausman says one of the greatest lines about like, or Clifton asks him if he likes this more than war. And he says, you know, ultimately like he didn't like war, but he liked knowing at least which side was the right side or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene, from that scene on, I liked the movie. Prior to that, I can't say that. I can't say that.
All right. Yeah. Max von Sydow's character, Joubert, I think every scene he's in is just so well done. First of all, just going back to the beginning, I get why they were setting, how they set the tone up of like how this office operates, that they're all very casual with each other. It does not seem at all like a CIA or a government, you know, operation. The one like military guy is kind of stuck in like a coat closet, it seemed like, and yeah. is kind of yeah. behind everything that's going on. But and it's very vague kind of what they do. I think they, you know, it's not very clear exactly what their job is. You don't really find out till later, but right. But what that, you know, and then of course it's convenient timing that when Turner goes out to, it's his turn to pick up lunch, and he goes out the back door the one time these guys are watching the front door. And that invasion, I think, is so well done and so violent that these people that you've just watched for like 15 minutes and kind of like, you know, in that amount of time, you a little bit get to know them, like you see personality in each of them, and they're just one by one just eliminated. And yeah, and when they, it's brutal, especially the way they kill Janice too, of like they confront
politely
her
asking her to step away from the window. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the mailman just like maneuvering himself around so he's not going to shoot out the window, and then yeah. they just kill her. Like it's staged really well. The tension is really well done. The tension in that scene in the elevator is fantastic. And I think those are our kind of reminiscent of Hitchcock kind of moments.
Sure.
Cliff Robertson, who's not one of, in general, not one of my favorite actors, is really good in this film. And you never know, like, is the when Turner's on the run, you know, he comes back, discovers the bodies, calls in for help and backup, and to be not backup but to be brought in from the field. And from then on, like, I like the way the government is shown of like, are they trying to help him or are they the ones behind this?
Right,
you don't really get that answer.
Yeah,
so
you
much
don't
later.
Well, you get the sense pretty early that the government's trying to get rid of him, that they're in the mix on whatever's happening, but you don't know to what extent and who and how deep it goes and what, like, who's actually pulling the strings. Like, you know, yeah. who some of the players are, but you don't know who all of them are.
Right.
Which is, you know, I mean, it's effective. Like it's, you know, like it makes sense, and that kind of mystery is good and helps what, you know, it helps with the payoff at the end, you yeah. know, like the last 30 minutes.
Yeah. You know, especially when, you know, they send, so Higgins, who Cliff Robertson plays, he sends Wicks, the who's technically Turner's boss, who he reports to, even though they've never met.
Played by a gentleman named Michael Caine, but not the Michael Caine you're thinking of.
Yeah. You know, when he goes to pick up Turner, and then once Turner reveals himself, he, you know, shoots his friend and, you know, tries to kill Turner. And then you realize, like, okay, so Wicks is obviously in on it and is, you know, bad, but is Cliff Robertson, like, is he as well? And you never really know about him. Like, how much does he know? Is he in on it? Is he not in on it? He's very expressionless until the end. He's very kind of untrustworthy.
It is kind of interesting because you're right. We never do really know if we can trust him. And, you know, the way that Sydow lays out everything at the end and Guy kind of gives his last final speech, you know, which is brilliantly delivered, but he talks about how, you know, Redford's not, it's basically not going to be safe for Redford back in New York. And this is how it's going to go down. And he kind of goes down the checklist of like what to expect when something's going to happen. And the thing that he opens up with basically is that someone will pull up in a car and someone, you know, someone you trust will get out.
It would happen this way. You may be walking. Maybe the first sunny day of the spring. And a car will slow beside you. And a door will open. And someone you know, maybe even trust, will get out of the car. And he will smile. A becoming smile. But he will leave open the door of the car and offer to give you a lift.
And that ends up being Robertson in that last scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that we ever really trusted him, right? Like,
no.
So it would have been, I felt like it was a little bit of a miss. Like, I like the character and I like that they tied it up there, but like, we don't trust Robertson. So it's not really a guy that Redford trusts.
Well, there's nobody left that he trusted anyway, though.
Yeah, I know. I understand. If it was Faye Dunaway, maybe.
Yeah. Right.
But that would have been, God, that would have been so cheap.
Yeah, that wouldn't have worked. Wouldn't have worked. I know.
Well, I was watching the film, I'm like, oh, I really hope they don't put some like double cross that she, you know, she planted herself for all this. Like, she's in on it from the beginning. Like, I was like, oh God, please don't do this.
That would have been totally horrible. Yeah, I get why it's Robertson.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really tell you how much time is. I mean, I guess it's the spring, right?
It's Christmas time.
They were in
the. Yeah, well, it's a Christmas movie, by the way.
Yeah, sure is. I mean, so when they're walking out of the house after that final scene at Atwood's study, there's snow on the car. So it's winter or end of winter. And then in his laying out of things, he says it'll happen in spring. So you have to imagine a little bit of time has passed and we don't know. Right?
Did time pass? Feel like that much time has gone by. I feel like it's pretty condensed.
Okay.
But, okay. I think that, you know, they're all in such a rush to find him and bring him in that I think this is all happening pretty
quickly.
Close
the loop. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That scene where Max von Sydow kind of turns at Atwood's, you know, his study is another really well done scene. That Redford is almost just like an onlooker there.
Oh, he's along for the ride. Sydow owns that scene.
Totally. And, you know, really kind of lays everything out of why he's done it. And it makes sense. His character, I think, was very logical and made sense that, you know, he was hired to do a job. He missed one of them. So he owes it to them. He's got to pay that debt.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, it flips that, you know, once he gets rehired to like get rid of Atwood. So that canceled the debt against Turner. And then they almost become friends. Like they're
almost allies. Well, he recruits him for a second. Like he definitely gives him the pitch to like come to Europe and do what he's doing. And Redford's like, oh, I just love America.
That's okay. Redford. That's Robert Redford. That's
true. He was a patriot. They've sold his patriotism in this one.
But you could see a sequel. They did not make one, but you could see one happening with, you know, that's where that character goes next.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So one other thing that's kind of fuzzy, and I'm not sure if it was intentionally that fuzzy or just that's how it came across, is what did Turner actually uncover that led to this whole thing?
It's ridiculously unclear. Until the very end, there's like, I feel maybe I just missed it, like you said, John, but I feel like the only reference to it is, I don't know if it was Kathy or somebody said something about, they were talking about, he was kind of laying out, you know, he had figured out these different books and there was this one book that was only done in these two languages. And then she mentioned Spanish as well. And he's like, oh, Spanish. And he like sits up in his chair. And then we don't know anything about it until the end, where they like talk about how basically those three countries are the ones that are running the oil trade. Right.
Right.
And it's like, well, comes out of, felt a little bit out of, like, I mean, I guess it was all accurate. I would assume it's all accurate, but like, unless you were in the seven, like, I don't think for modern viewers, like, anybody's tracking that. I don't know if viewers in the 70s knew that or not, right?
Like, I don't know if they cared, you know, either. Like,
yeah, that's true.
I think, you know, we're relying on being told what happened because we never see it. It's already happened by the time the movie starts. So we are relying on the characters to tell us and explain to us. And they do it in a very vague way that, yeah, that, so these books have been translated into three languages, and it leads them to the fact that America was inserting itself and creating sort of an insurgence in the Middle East to upset the, you know, who's in control of the oil, which is, that idea is, you know, rings, how true to ring, how true does that ring today with what's happened in the years since and you know, ongoing?
I don't even feel like they make it clear that Redford is like a code breaker, because even in his big scene where he's talking about, I mean, he litters throughout, oh, I read books, you know, but like, even in his big scene where he's kind of really explaining what he does, like he talks about how he finds things in books that can be used, like, and what that means, whether it's code breaking or whether it's like ideas for attacks or whatever, like is never like clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, mm-hmm. it's a lot of vague. It's a lot of vagary.
I'd be interested. I haven't read the book that this is based on, which is 6 Days of the Condor.
I bet they have more time to talk about what he actually does.
Well, I'd be curious. They have 3 extra days to talk
about.
3 extra days
to get into the details.
But I'd be curious, you know, novels or, and books are always, you know, it's easier to explain things than having to do it visually in a film. So I wonder if they lay it out a little better there.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately, like, it all boils down to that last scene between Turner and Higgins out right in front of the New York Times, that Turner's revealed that he's given the whole story to the Times and they're going to print it. And what we're left with is Higgins saying, like, do you actually think they're going to print it? Like, they're not going to run that story. And we never know. Like,
we,
if they
know.
I like that last shot that leaves, you know, on Turner's face as he kind of disappears into the crowd, but there's that worry that, like, oh, this isn't, like, maybe they aren't going to run it, and if they don't run it, these guys are going to be after me forever.
Well, I think and it's all, but it's the paranoia of they can control what's in the newspaper, which is like that's the big, you know, they can control the information.
Right.
Which a lot of people would say also rings true to nowadays.
And if they can control, if it's even out there, like, and no one would believe him, why even kill him at this? Now you don't even have to kill him. Like, he could just live in his paranoia and then, and suppress anything he, you know, tries to do.
Yeah, I mean, and this is that part of the 70s conspiracy films that I really love. I love that kind of dark ending that it's unknown what's going to happen to this character. It's, you know, just like in The Conversation and, you know, so many of those other films that, you know, what is the next for these characters if they survive the movie? Where do they go next? You know, The Conversation, again, you can check that out in the archives at reconcinimation.com. We talked about how that movie basically years later, there's sort of a unofficial sequel, Enemy of the State, where Gene Hackman is basically playing the same character again. We don't get that, but I'm sure we could have with 3 Days of the Condor. Very similar circumstance.
Hmm.
But that distrust of the government and that feeling of betrayal is so prevalent in many of these films, you know, Marathon Man, we talked about, this film, parallax view, the conversation, it, all the president's men, it just kind of goes on. That was really so dominant, you know, the anger at the government for the way Vietnam was handled, and Nixon for a lot of things, Watergate being the biggest. It's just people were really angry in the world. This was really that, that 60s and 70s where the world really changed, and then, you know, changes again in a different direction in the 80s with Reaganism and, you know, capitalism really becoming so huge. And yeah, it's I don't know, just such a fascinating time period that I love looking back at these movies. Even though, you know, time has shown us that they're not all these films are not perfect, and some are problematic in certain ways, and some story-wise don't work. I think we feel some of that here. I feel like Marathon Man was a little tighter than this film. You didn't feel that way?
I don't know.
I don't know. Which one are you more critical of the story? I feel like you went in on this one, though. I feel like you liked what Marathon Man was doing a little bit more. I mean, I think
that's what I mean. I think Marathon Man works,
yeah,
you know, better than this one does.
But I'm saying to Brent, I don't know. He's a little on the fence here. Which, all right, Brent, we need the final.
There are significant plot holes in Marathon Man that I think make it incomplete. I don't know that I find plot holes in this one, but there are things in this movie that straight up just I find gross that make me not enjoy it. Like them being vague about things never really made me feel like I was missing elements of the story. Like it just felt like part of the storytelling. Whereas like, I feel like in Marathon Man, there are just pieces missing. And again, it's a bunch of gibberish that is held together by really great intermittent scenes throughout. I don't know. I have a hard time. I have a hard time. I don't really love either one of them. I think in the last podcast I said I liked 3 Days of the Condor, but I think after rewatching it, I take that back, but because it had been so long since I had seen it. I don't really love either one of them. I don't know. They both finish really strong. That's all I can really say. For both of them, the last 30 minutes are their best 30 minutes. Those are what you need to watch. And there are scenes, I guess, for both that are sprinkled throughout. I just feel like the plot holes in Condor are not as egregious, but there are other things that are just as more offensive. So, yeah, I don't know. Sorry, I didn't necessarily want to say that I liked one more than the other, David. I just had to think about it because I was curious.
I dislike
both of them for different reasons.
I thought it'd be interesting to expound on that, because I mean I there's very little about your opinions on these I disagree with at all, like, and I'm just like, no, this all makes sense. And I think probably if these were, I had seen these movies before, I think I could get a little more worked up about it, but like for me, just because I'd gone through it only once more or less discuss, I don't see the flaws as quickly, and it's like, oh yeah, it's really, yeah, Jesus Christ, this one, it gets worse as we keep talking about it, because you guys are pointing out. But like, you know, it's funny how much I forgave as I was watching. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like, whereas I feel like I get a little more critical on, I think I'm more critical on movies that were made like when I existed, like, you know, like when I was
sure,
you know, but like. I almost like forgive it a little, forgive these sins a little bit. There's very little I disagree with at all. Like I think even down to Redford's performance and like the kind of character he is, it's like, it's just like, this is the guy, like
Like, this is our hero. Like, this is our hero.
Yeah. This is like the number. Just there's some like, well, Redford's great. There's maybe something incongruent about him actually being in the role versus, I don't know. I feel like you kind of need like a little bit of a dork in there. He's not a dork at all.
He tried to dork it up.
He had those glasses, you know?
Yeah. that he didn't need. They were like on and off whenever. Like, okay.
Yeah. What do you think?
That's John? What I mean, that they really leaned on the fact that it's Redford. You know, they leaned on him bringing so much to the role, because we really don't know much about Turner, whether or not we even like him.
Yeah.
So other than it is Robert Redford, it's like Clooney. It's very similar to Clooney being cast in a role like this, that there's so much that comes with a lot of these stars when they hit a certain level, that like they're bringing with them their likability because you like them as the star that they are. Clooney, Gosling, people like that.
Well, and they play him up at the beginning, like a little bit like a fish out of water. Like, and he'll, you know, throughout the course of the movie, they're like, he's not a field agent. So, you know, like he's not.
He's always late. And
He's late. Like, he rides to work on a bike that immediately, like, for whatever reason, had me thinking of Dumb and Dumber, like just the way he was like made up and riding into work. But he's late. He's, you know, stealing donuts from the back office and sitting down and, you know, just being kind of laid back. And you don't think of a CIA agent as being like this laid back guy. So they're obviously trying to force this likable persona, but then like once the shit hits the fan, like he is not likable at all. Like everything he does for the large majority of the beginning of the movie is not likable. So it's a hard sell, man. Hard sell.
I do think, to David's point, that the first time watch for this, what you're pointing out doesn't, I mean, the Faye Dunaway stuff, yeah, but some of the other things I don't think jump out at you until you're on a rewatch with it. It's one of those, I think the more you watch it, the more that stuff is going to stand out. Yeah. First time watch, I feel like, right, David, like some of that stuff didn't bother you nearly as bad as we're kind of laying it out. And it really didn't. Some of this stuff, like his performance, didn't bother me as much as it did you, Brent. But I see what you're saying.
I liked him because he's Robert Redford, and he's like, you know,
Who doesn't love engaging. Robert Redford?
But is he ideal for this role? It doesn't seem like it. Like it's kind of a miscast. Like,
hard when I said earlier that like it was hard for me to wrap my head around saying that I think that Robert Redford is not good in this movie, because I like Robert Redford a lot. You know, like I think he's like many of his movies I've seen over and over and over again. And so that was a little bit of even a curveball for me. But I watched
it, he doesn't belong in this.
Yeah, like, I was like, this is really rough for me. You know, like I don't like this character at all. Like this character is awful, basically, is what I was. And I'm like, and he's wearing a Ted Bundy mask, like basically.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
But it's the thing. I there was so much I could forgive just as a first time watcher, because the things that did grab you and pull you into as the thriller of it all, like I think can sustain. But then now that the thrill is gone, if I were to rewatch it, I'd probably be a lot more bored, and then I'd be more. Like again, the whole thing, like him sleeping with her, like the day after having her tied up, and I'm just like, come on, man! Like I was like, she's gonna say I love you, like by the end of this movie, and I'm gonna be so mad, because how those characters fall in love and within a couple days, within the scope of a movie, and I love you, like what? No, you just met this guy anyway, it's fascinating to see like there's problems with this, just like there were problems with Marathon Man, but I mean I don't necessarily need to see this movie again. We're not at that part of the show, right? But if I did, I think, yeah, I'd be a little more like ready to talk about the problematic stuff. Like, absolutely. Yeah. Or just stuff that doesn't work.
This was only a second time, I think second time, maybe third of viewing for me, and it'd been a long time. So
yeah,
I loved it the first time I saw it, but that's, I think, a good point, David, that I was really leaning on the thrills and, you know, the tension and what was going to happen to this guy and where it was all going to end up. Once that is answered, other things stand out to you. And this is kind of, I think, what Brent's point is what jumping out now that element is now gone.
Did anybody else get the whole like Casablanca vibe from their goodbye at the train station? Like, to me, the smoke in the background, like there's like smoke in the background and all sorts of stuff. Like, it is, go back and rewatch it, dude. It is 100% their Casablanca goodbye.
It's probably a nice homage.
Yeah, it probably is. It just didn't jump out at me watching it.
Yeah.
And on the kiss, right?
I immediately was like, what? Like, what? Like, this is Casablanca now, guys? What?
Should we see how it did at the box office with a little box office glory? So let's see how Mr. Redford's charm, how much he charmed audiences here. The movie had a $7.8 million budget. It was shot in late 1974 in New York, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. It opened September 25th, 1975. It had a $41.5 million domestic run. So that's definitely a big hit of the day.
Yeah.
What is that in today's dollars? It's like
600 million. $7 billion, dollars, something like that.
Yeah, probably.
Real quick, I do have to say, I loved the New York City element of this. Like, just them shooting on the streets in New York, I thought was actually pretty great. Like, it felt
it's a great New York movie. It's a lot of Sidney Pollack films.
Yeah, it's a really good New York movie for sure. Like,
he's really good at just showcasing New York and getting the New York feeling and the streets and just really using that production value that it naturally has.
Yeah, that was actually pretty great.
You can almost say New York is another character in the film.
I was actually going to say that and I held back, but I'm glad you picked it up. Touchdown. I think
you teed me up for it. Yeah, absolutely.
It ended up as number 6 of 1975, sandwiched between Return of the Pink Panther and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And what was the top films of 1975? Well, it was Jaws, which was one of our very first episodes on this show. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Shampoo.
Have you guys done Cuckoo's Nest?
No, we've not done that yet. That is one of our big 70s movies
shall.
Next year is an anniversary year.
We could skip Shampoo.
Yeah, Shampoo's another one that, like, I loved it first time, and there's a lot of tough stuff with it now. But yeah, so the fallout of this movie is it's a big hit. It solidifies, you know, everybody who's already a top level personality. Sidney Pollack as director and Robert Redford, Faye Dunaway as stars. You know, that while there wasn't a lot of meat on the bone for Faye Dunaway in this movie and her character, but it certainly, being a part of a big film like this, was, you know, just another, you know, notch for her as well. That, you know, another big hit movie that was, you know, doing well. And this, you know, as we already mentioned, leads the pack of the 70s paranoia and conspiracy films that just would continue for the rest of the decade. It did get one Oscar nomination for editing. Didn't win, but it was nominated.
I know we're summarizing the end here, but like, what'd you call it? What do you guys think about the score, the music? Because
that 70s music at the very beginning was so
jazzy.
Yeah.
I was like, is this a 70s TV show?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I hate to bag on composers, but man, that was hilarious.
I was
thought, is this a comedy?
I was like, oh, I think this is the start of an Odd Couple episode. Like,
yeah, you know, like, that's what it sounded like.
That's exactly what it sounded like.
It was very out of place feeling. And it's Dave Grusin is the composer who I generally love. And, you know, he did the score for The Goonies, which I was an epic one in my brain. So,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But there was I met like, yeah, not to bag on that. It just, but there was something off about the music.
I don't think it was so weird the rest of the movie, but that opening, the opening scene, yeah. I was like, the Odd Couple opening that you just said is perfect. Like that's perfectly encapsulates the feeling of what this is.
I think the score for Marathon Man was so perfect for that. The tone that it set.
Yeah,
you know how it made you feel really like matched the tone of the movie, whereas this was like, whoa, what are like the beginning of that movie is so lighthearted up until the invasion. It's like, what, yeah, like this is a sitcom. Like,
yeah, it turns so dark after being just this whimsical kind of jaunt.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was Sidney Pollack like trying to set it up to like, you know, have you let your guard down and feel comfortable and relaxed, you know, with all of that combined. So maybe that was why he did it, or it could have just been kind of the style of the day. And it just is something that didn't age well.
They definitely don't take much time getting into the tension like that. That invasion scene happens pretty quick.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
once we start.
Mm-hmm. And then we kind of slow the pace down. That I did feel the pacing of the film was much slower than I remembered.
It's because it's just an awkward hour of watching Redford kidnap and build this relationship with Faye Dunaway, whatever that
And the whole time her boyfriend's waiting for her up in Vermont.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Never mind that.
And that was such a it was such an interesting phone call because the boyfriend is like, you know, he's just upset. And he's like, where are you? What's going on?
Yeah.
But I think he was just
like, are you okay?
Just, like, you're all right. Like, I just, you know, I really wanted to see you. And
yeah, like, you feel bad.
I was like,
him.
I was like, oh no, this is like, you know, because it'd be easier to make him a bad guy. Like, you know, just kind of a jerk.
Like the jerk boyfriend. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, he's just a jerk because he was mad. And then it's a nice little, like, I felt very real. And I kind of liked it.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. So, we didn't even get into the photographs, but whatever.
He like analyzes her art and that's how they connect, you know?
Yeah.
But apparently she has a different set of photos that she can not show him at the beginning because she didn't know him well enough. But at the end, she can show him now.
Mm-hmm.
Check out these photos.
They're emotionally connected.
Yeah, they are.
Well, sure. I'm emotionally connected to you guys, and I just love having you, whether, you know, go through these movies, whether we love them, don't love them, or it's a mix. It's always fun.
It's good to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole purpose of what we're talking about here is, you know, we're our catchphrase that we use every episode, rewind, rewatch, reconsider.
Right.
Trademark.
Every episode we say that.
I'm going to work that.
We always weave it in.
Yeah. I'm going to work it back in. That's what we do. We're seeing, you know, how these movies have changed over time for us. And this was an interesting one to look at. And the fact that it had, you know, as a movie that I had really loved. And there's things about it that I love very much still, but there's also things that are very problematic and haven't aged well. So, so this was a good one.
Yeah, I would have loved. I would have loved to see a young George Clooney like do this right after he left DR. Do like redo this movie. He's like, he was still at the age. He'd be the perfect age for it. Kind
of. He did right. Ides of March isn't this? This it's kind of the same.
Well,
oh, is it?
Not really. I would say a better comp is Out of Sight. That there's
okay.
Super problem. Like that was a great movie when it came out. A lot of people still consider it a great film, but when you watch it now, there is problematic things in their relationship that is tough to kind of like sit through.
All right.
Well, I'm not going to watch Out of Sight then.
Now we're just talking people out of watching movies.
Yeah.
Don't watch
Skip it.
It's time for Brent and Dave's.
We hate everything. Skip it. Pass.
Skip it.
Yeah.
Ship it.
Well, you know, it was fun to look back at some of these conspiracy, 70s paranoia films this month. There's others like the Parallax View that I do want to look at as well. But we're going to move on. And the month of May, we're going to have some blockbuster movies that I think I'm excited about talking, you know, with you guys. We may have a guest on for one of them, but we're going to be spending the month looking at the early days of James Cameron.
Oh, yes.
And we are going to look at
Piranha 2.
Piranha 2. Oh. Now, we are going to look at The Terminator and The Abyss.
I'm excited. Ooh. I'm excited for both of these movies.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to talk about with both. Yeah. Terminator has been on our list, like constantly getting moved around. Finally, we found a home for it. So, yeah, it's
Michael Biehn classics.
Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah. Michael Biehn all the way. Michael May.
All day, every day.
It's May.
It's Michael May.
Yeah. Well, great. You know, and just to say again, I'm sure many of you listening, you know, haven't seen a lot of Sidney Pollack films. Go back and watch some of his, you know, 70s things, Jeremiah Johnson, They Shoot Horses, Don't They, which we will cover on the show at some point. Tootsie, we're going to definitely talk about. So, An Absence of Malice, those are ones that definitely should check out. And then, you know, The Firm is another big kind of blockbuster one of the 90s.
Yeah. And if you're a Seidel fan, definitely check this movie out.
Definitely.
Because he is 100% the best part and is amazing. If you're a Redford fan, skip it.
Well, there's a lot of Redford. So if you love him, like, there's a lot of him to see here. All right. Well, you know, check us out. Check out our archives at reconcinimation.com. Hit us up on social media. Don't forget, we got our mailbag episode coming up. So drop us a line, drop us some questions, anything inside, inside questions about the business or movies in general, whatever you got, throw them our way. We'll hit that in an upcoming episode. Shout out to our friends, EK Wimmer for the theme music, Curtis Moore for the poster, as usual. Always doing a great job, those guys. And don't forget, also coming up very soon, our 200th episode spectacular. We have a very special event planned for that. So stay tuned as that's coming up. And we will see you guys next time on Reconcinimation. Rewind, rewatch, reconsider.
Take care.
Cowabunga.